What do you call 30 million of us?
Mm-hmm.
What do you call 30 million
polar
of us?
Bears.
You call us polar bears.
Polar bears.
Nice. Okay. We're on the bottom of page 26, side B. We're going to turn the page. This is one of those page turner classes. And today we're going to weave the fabric of another opinion. In the previous class, we discussed the origin for the notion that in order for fabric to be considered fabric, in other words, not just threads, but something of value and importance, so that it could be mekabel tuma, so that it could become ritually impure, because it has to be an object, it has to be something of value. So we talked about this notion of three fingers by three fingers, a very small little swatch. We talked about a larger swatch of fabric, which is three tvachim. And we trace the origins back to the psukim, to the verses that describe the paranormal kind of discoloration known as tzaras, which can afflict a wide variety of things, including people, Chesterfields, the walls of your stone house, and yes, even your clothing. And we talked about the details of the clothing and the materials that the clothing have to be made of, and that served as the origin. However, before that, there were two opinions. There were two opinions. And now we're going to go to the second opinion. We're going back to the second opinion, which is the opinion of Rava. The opinion of Rava was that when it comes to negoyim, when it comes to the lesions, the paranormal for appearance's sake only, then a piece of cloth which is made of wool and linen will become ritually impure, even if it's the tiny size of three fingers by three fingers. But if it's other kinds, not wool and linen, other kinds of fabric, it will still become ritually impure, not with three fingers by three fingers, but with a larger piece of cloth. The larger piece of cloth, according to Rava, would apply to all substances, not only wool and linen, and this is as long as it's outside of the concept of negoyim, other forms of ritual impurity. Capish, kind of? Did I lose anybody yet? No?
Yeah.
A little bit? I lost you? Okay, let me repeat that again. So, when it comes to the notion of negayim, negayim is this idea of these lesions, okay? Think of tzaras, the more common name for it. When it comes to lesions, the Torah is very specific. The Torah says that it's talking about wool or linen. So, because the Torah is so specific in telling us that it's talking about fabric that's comprised of wool and linen, and because the Torah, if we learn the Gemara properly, learn the Pesukim properly as the Gemara explained it to us, even a tiny piece of fabric could still be considered meaningful. We talked about rich people and poor people, small swatches, big swatches. This was all in our previous class, which I think you missed. So we said that when it comes to negoyim, it's three by three. And when it comes to all kinds of ritual impurity, if it's wool and linen, that's the size. If it's not wool and linen, then it doesn't become ritually impure. Hmm. But according to Rava, in his understanding of the opinion of Reb Shimon ben Elazar, was that when it comes to negoyim, when it comes to wool and linen and other things, it's three by three. When it comes to other kinds of fabric outside of negoyim, which is one type of ritual impurity, because there are 15 different forms of ritual impurity, then even if it's other fabric, it could still become ritually impure. However, the size would need to be three tefachim by three tefachim, approximately a square foot. Okay? A larger swatch of cloth. Everything we talked about in the previous opinion was not the opinion of Rava. It was the opinion that we had this very clear divide between the ritual impurity engendered through negoyim and other forms of ritual impurity. And those are clearly spelled out in the pasuk.
In other words, for example, tumat met would not be acquired by nylon cloth measuring 2 inches by
right.
2 inches.
Right, correct. So the Gemara, we are now going to weave the fabric of the second opinion. So far, we only know about the first opinion. But the first opinion seems very clear. There's a very clear distinction between the tumah, the ritual impurity engendered or caught, sustained by garments which are made of wool and linen and other kinds of ritual impurity or other kinds of garments. The Torah is very, very clear, very specific. It spells out the actual fabric, the material, wool and linen. So the Gemara says like this. What about L'Rava? L'Rava, and according to Rava, the Omer that Rava said, Shalesha al Shalesha, B'Sha'ar B'Godim, Ikebinayu, that the distinction between Reb Shimon ben Elazar and the Tana Devei Rabbi Shmuel would be found in other garments. And I'm not going to go over the whole Machlekes from three classes ago. But Rava said that the difference would be found in other garments. That's where Reb Shimon ben Elazar and Tana Devei Rabbi Shmuel have their dispute. Other garments are required 3 by 3, or other garments will require 3 tefachim by 3 tefachim, which is more like 12 inches. So, the Reb Shimon ben Elazar, so according to Reb Shimon ben Elazar, we have this ritual impurity, as we said. Islay Latana Devei Rabbi Shmuel, that Reb Shimon ben Elazar Islay, he does hold of this ritual impurity. And according to the way Rava understood the Machlekes, Latana Devei Rabbi Shmuel, Le'Slay Shlash Shlash Shabashar Begadim. The Tana Devei Rabbi Shmuel would not hold of the idea of 3 tefachim by 3 tefachim with regard to other garments. So now, in other words, like this. The whole limud, the way we trace back the origin of this biblical law, was making a very clear distinction between the goyim and between the other forms of ritual impurity. But according to Rava, that distinction is not so clear. Because fabric can become ritually impure in one way when it comes to the goyim, but it can become ritually impure in another way when it comes to other forms of ritual impurity. So according to Rava, you wouldn't be able to say that this limud, that this source from which we can derive, the original source, which makes that clear distinction, wouldn't really filter through to the opinion of Rava, who says that we don't have such a clear distinction between the negoyim, between the tzaras, the wool and linen, and the other kinds of garments. So from whence will Rava be able to find the meaning of this halacha? Where will he get this from? In other words, the Gemara is saying we have to weave the fabric for Rava now. We wove a fabric last week for the opinion for the opinion that made a distinction between Reb Shimon ben Elazar and Tana Devei Rabbi Shmuel, where the argument was whether this idea applies only to Negoyim or not. But according to Rava, that the idea is not so clear-cut, where will he get this the origin of this halacha from? That's how the Gemara introduces it. And the Gemara now, on page Chav Zayin, is going to set out to weave this second opinion. So minole. From where? We went from Chavav.
Amid Beis. On the next page now.
On to Chav Zayin. Minole. The first words on page Chav Zayin, page 27. You may now turn your page. Minole. From where would Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar know this teaching? So the Gemara answers as follows. Me'oi beged, from the word or a garment. Let me give you some background here. There are 8 rodents who are identified in the Torah as being a source of ritual impurity. They're called shrotzim, sheretz. Sheretz means a creepy crawler. Truth be told, there are millions of creepy crawlers, or at least hundreds of thousands of species. But there are 8 specific kinds of creepy crawlers, things that slither on the ground, like a rat, like a muskrat, like a hedgehog, things like this. We don't even know with certainty what they are anymore. We think we know what they are. I'm not 100% sure. A toad. So the Shmeinah Shratzim necessarily engender a unique kind of ritual impurity. That is to say, broadly speaking, life is an expression of divinity, expression of godliness. Godliness is the animating force, and therefore, when something is alive, it reflects the Creator. When something dies, so then there is an element of its animation that is now gone. So there's an emptiness, if you will. There was an expression of the Creator that was seen in the living reality, and that is now void, it's emptied, it's become emptied. Because it's become emptied, It allows for extraneous or non-holiness to fill the vacuum. Just like when a building which is filled with people empties out and suddenly it's filled with drugs and gangs and prostitution. Just like when an abandoned city, an abandoned town like they have today in Northern Ontario empties out and all of a sudden creepy crawlers move in. This is the nature. The nature of things are is that when things are emptied, vacuums do not remain empty. Vacuums become a place in which something else will fill. No, nothing remains empty. And therefore, for example, it's a good idea not to leave your head empty. Because if your head is empty of meaningful thought and meaningful ideas, it will be filled with narishkeit or worse. It's a given. It's granted. That's the way it is. So if somebody is dealing with lots of narishkeit, what's the answer? Fill your head with lots of good things. The more good things you put on your head, the better off you're going to be. This is true on many levels. So ritual purity is something in which means this, where it's a recipient to the presence of God. Now, not every time something dies does it engender ritual impurity. It's a fact that trees are alive. When you chop a tree down, thank you, when you chop a tree down, it doesn't create death. There is no death engendered by logs or wood. Even if the tree isn't shechted, even if the tree collapses by itself, it still is not a source of ritual impurity. That's a fact. Why? But it was alive. Maybe when you eat tomatoes, you should be ritually impure because the tomatoes used to be alive. And then somebody cruelly killed them. Why people are not worried about cruelty towards tomatoes but are worried about cruelty towards chicken? I don't know. I'm not sure. What's the difference? They're both alive. Because one could cry out loud. Maybe tomatoes cry quietly. Whatever. This is a parenthetical thing. So going back to our point, not everything that dies is necessarily going to become ritually impure. Not everything that dies. The cut grass is not a problem. The blades of grass do not become ritually impure. What's the highest form of ritual impurity?
Tumas mace.
What kind of mace is the highest form of ritual impurity? A human being. What kind of human being? What kind of human being creates the greatest ritual impurity?
One who was purest to start with.
And who might that be?
Tzaddik.
No. A tzaddik, or a kohen, or a nozir, or a regular person, all have the same level of ritual impurity. But the Torah says that a Jew, a dead Jew, is more impure than a dead non-Jew. Why? Why are we more impure? Because the difference between a Jew and a non-Jew is capacity for conduction of holiness. That's it. We're not smarter. We're not richer. We're not more clever. I can assure you, actually, about all these things. I know lots of non-clever, non-smart, and non-rich Jews. It's just a fact. You don't need to have any of these qualities to be Jewish. I know Jews of every color and every creed. So what is the meaning of being Jewish? The definition of what makes a Jew, your mother's Jewish, you convert according to halacha. That's the definition. There is nothing else. There is no other definition of being Jewish. But what does it mean? Okay, so I'm Jewish. So what does that mean? The answer is it means that I have the opportunity and the responsibility of doing mitzvahs. And what are mitzvahs? Mitzvahs are conventions through which holiness is conducted. Just like a wire conducts electricity, and just like metal in general is a conductor, and just like rubber does not conduct, and just like when wood conducts electricity, it bursts into flames. So there are different substances that can conduct different forms of energy differently. A Jew is uniquely suited to conduct a godly energy through a specific formula known as a mitzvah. Now, every human being conducts holiness, and that's why every human being has mitzvahs. There are seven broad concepts of mitzvahs, which are many more than seven, by the way, but seven ideas of mitzvahs which are binding on every human being. Every human being is indeed created in God's image. Every human being can and should try to nurture a relationship with God, and that's achieved through performance of mitzvahs. But we, the Jewish people, have many, many more mitzvahs, many more responsibilities and obligations and privileges spiritually. So because of that, Because of this, what happens is that when a Jew dies, this body that was endowed with the ability to conduct holiness is now left void and vacant. So what's left in a void? What occupies a vacancy?
Creepy crawlers.
Ritual impurity. So the most impure thing is the thing that's capable of conducting the greatest holiness. What's the difference between a Jew and a non-Jew insofar as ritual purity is concerned? Something called tumas oihel. Oihel means an enclosure. So if a Jewish body is under that roof, it creates ritual impurity. When it's a non-Jewish body, oi, you have to actually touch the body. To actually touch the body, or prod the body, or move the body in order to become ritually impure. Okay, so how about animals? So first of all, animals do not have the opportunity to do mitzvahs. It doesn't matter how much people like their dogs, or how heroic they think a dog might be. The dog is just simply responding to instinct. He's not a good dog or a bad dog. The dog who's trained to bite people is not a bad dog or a good dog. Depending on which side you are on, he may be bad or good for you. If you're the intruder, you're not good. He's not good for you. If you're the victim, the would-be victim, the dog is very good for you. What is the dog? He's neither. He's trained to bite. You're an intruder, he bites you. End of story. The Nazi dogs weren't evil. The Nazis were evil. The evil people were the Nazis. The dogs were dogs. Dogs do what dogs do. So what happens to a dead dog? We say Kaddish. Does he have ritual impurity? So the thing is this. Animals do have a level of ritual impurity not equal to humans, and not because they're capable of doing mitzvahs. Precisely because they're not. It's a dialed down, lesser level. Why is there ritual impurity? Because they still are possessive of a divine spirit, a divine animating force. And you can see it. A dog has emotions. A dog has feelings. A dog is independent, as is an orangutan, as is a bunny rabbit. So therefore, a dead carcass of an animal like that makes you ritually impure. I know what you're thinking. So every time you sit down and eat a piece of roast beef, you become ritually impure? The answer is, if it's not kosher, yes. An animal that's ritually slaughtered does not become impure. An animal that's not ritually slaughtered, but dies or is killed in a hunt, is ritually impure. That's called a nevela, tumas nevela. That's a form of ritual impurity. Is every dead bee and every dead mosquito and every dead caterpillar a source of ritual impurity? The answer is no. A dead fish a source of ritual impurity? The answer is no. No. In general, the laws of ritual purity and impurity don't exactly make sense. It's a divine thing which you don't really understand.
Is wine the same thing?
Wine?
Non-kosher wine.
Non-kosher wine is not connected to ritual impurity. Not at all. Non-kosher wine is connected to the concept of non-kosher food, which is a different kind of unholiness. It's a totally different thing.
But it can conduct.
Foodstuffs, edibles, can conduct ritual impurity. Yeah. That's known as tumas oichlin. The oichel is a conductor. So we're not talking about conductors now. We're talking about sources of ritual impurity. There's one set of halachas called sources. That's various sources. There are actually 15 kinds of ritual impurity with unique halachas for each one. And then there's a separate set of halachas which is called how and what conducts ritual impurity. Not everything's a conductor. Just like when it comes to electricity. Rubber is not a conductor. Wood is a dangerous conductor. And metal is a phenomenal conductor. It's just things that either conducted or don't conduct it. We talked about in the previous class about the ritual impurity which is engendered through negoyim, which is, by the way, an extremely severe source of ritual impurity. It says metzora choshuv kemes. The person who's stricken with ritual impurity can be almost as extreme in its form as the dead. Why is that? How do stones become a source of ritual impurity if they have tzaras? How does a piece of leather become a source of ritual impurity if it has tzaras? And so it is with garments. So now we're talking about a different form. As a rule, creepy crawlers do not become ritually impure. But there are eight rodents that do become impure. And those are called Shemona Shratzim. Or, as the Mishnah puts it, Shemona Shratzim Ha'amurim Batorah. Eight, very specific, eight Shratzim who are enumerated in the Torah. So now we're going to move from Tzaras to weave this opinion. In order to create the fabric of this opinion, we're going to go from Tzaras, we're going to now take a look at a different form of ritual impurity. This form of ritual impurity is known as Shratzim. So there's a Pasuk. The Pasuk is found in the 11th chapter of the book of Leviticus. It's actually the 32nd verse. It says there, V'chol asher yipol alav mehem b'moisam yitma. Anything upon which they will fall, namely the carcass, this hedgehog, this rat, this toad, it will fall onto these different things, they will become ritually... they will become ritually impure. Now the Torah spells it out, and it says, Mikol kli'etz oi beged. Any wood artifact, people make a mistake of thinking a keli means a cup or a bowl. That's not correct. A keli, in Hebrew, at least in legal jargon of the Mishnah, refers to an artifact. Eyeglasses are a keli. This is not a clump of metal or glass. This has a specific form. Some say, what is that? I don't know. It's plastic and metal. No, it's eyeglasses. It's what's called tzura and chomer. This form and this matter. So this no longer is just matter. It is matter. It is plastic. It is rubber. It is metal. But that's not what it is. It's a pair of eyeglasses. This this book is pulp. It was once a tree. Yeah, this is not a tree. Well, I was one day sitting at the table and looking at a former tree. What are you talking about? Yeah, it's a former tree. No, this is not a former tree. This is a form. This is a book. In fact, to be specific, if somebody said, what is that? I would say it's a gemara. It's what it is. In the same way, clothing is not wool. It's not a pile of linen. It's clothing. So kli eitz means not a block of wood, but something that has a form to it. It could be anything from a pen to a box to a ball to whatever is useful, a handle, a hook, anything which is fashioned of wood but has a specific name attached to it, because the name is given to it because it has a specific use attached to it. That's called a keli. Or a beged. What's a beged? Is a beged a collection of threads, a collection of fabric? No, it's not a beged. A beged is an article of clothing. So, if I ask for a specific or definitive definition for this, what would the answer be? The answer would be, that would be the answer. This is a suit jacket. That's what this is. But if I want to give a non-definitive description, what would this be? Clothing, not cloth. This is, nobody will say that's cloth. They'll say it's clothing. Bag of clothing. You wouldn't say a bag of cloth. Somebody gives you a bag, people sometimes get rid of old clothes. If you find somebody who has needs, it's a bag. They say, I have a bag of cloth here. Would you like it? What are we going to do with cloth? And so I have a bag of clothes. And then it could be a little more general yet specific. I have a bag of baby's clothes. I have a bag of men's clothes. I have a bag of women's clothes. I have a bag of casual clothes. I have a bag of dress clothes. I have a bag of business attire. This is called a beged. Yes? This was the question here. In order for somebody to become ritually pure, it cannot simply have matter. Matter does not conduct ritual impurity. The electricity doesn't care if the wire is a wire or if it's a metal rod, or if it doesn't matter if when the lightning hits, anything that conducts electricity will conduct electricity. Ritual impurity is not like electricity. It's a metaphor. Ritual impurity requires both matter as well as
form.
Style, form. It can't just have substance. It has to have style attached to it. If it doesn't have style, it cannot conduct ritual impurity. If it doesn't have form. So therefore, our question that we're discussing here is whether a piece of fabric is a piece of fabric, meaning a collection of threads, or no, it's a shmata. It's a piece of cloth. You know, they sell you these, talking about eyeglasses, these little pieces of cloth
for cleaning
your eyeglasses, which is made of special cloth. I forget the technology about it. They shrink and they have many more threads than is common. They get away with charging like $5 for those things. It's not a little piece of cloth. It actually comes from the same belt of cloth, like any belt of cloth, but they cut it in a certain way and they make it in a certain way, and it probably cost them 5 cents, and they charge you $5. Why? Because it's something chashuv.
Somebody will pay for it.
Well, the suckers are born every day, and we're going to pay for it because it's special cloth, and they make sure not to sell bolts of it. You can't buy it like a paper towel and just use as much of it as you want. And that cloth, they'll give it to you in a fancy little plastic case, and they'll present it in a whole nice way. They give you a whole klipa around it. So now you think you got a good deal. You got something special. And maybe they'll put some pictures on it and put a color into it. Or they'll put a designer name and you'll pay $20 for it. It is true, isn't it? It doesn't make your glasses any cleaner, but... when people see that piece of cloth, they don't say, "What's those threads over there? Or can you pass me those threads?" What do they say? "Pass me the glasses cleaner." Because it has a form attached to it. So it conducts ritual impurity because of its form. So the pasuk...
Does the form have to be usable form?
That's an excellent question, Ami. What is form if not a use?
Well,
if it doesn't have a specific set of uses or a specific use, with what does it have form? It becomes amorphous then. Then it's just a clump of matter.
Everything can get shaped by various means. That doesn't mean that it has any use to it.
Understood. So things which don't really have any particular use attached to it are generally not called kelim. You know that on Shabbos, you're not allowed to touch something which is a non-keli. It's considered muktzah. It's called off-limits. It's a rabbinic prohibition. So the most stringent form of muktzah is organic material, like a rock, a piece of wood. But if you take that rock and you paint it and make it a paperweight, or clean it and set it aside as a paperweight, then you can use that rock on Shabbos. Because it has a use.
You now made it into a tool.
You made it into an instrument, an artifact, correct. So the Torah says, oy beged. It doesn't say kli eitz ubeged, it says oy. Now we know, because, you know, we're learning Torah, that every single word of God's Torah is meaningful. And we know from modern technology, when you have this rich JavaScript or whatever it is that people write computer programming with, if you're missing one slash or one colon or one dot, the whole program collapses. It falls apart. It's all codes. The Bible code people are not entirely off. We do believe in codes in the Bible, just not in mumbo-jumbo codes. We believe that the Torah has all the wisdom we need, beginning with the wisdom required for us to fill our life with meaning. And we fill our life with meaning and we fulfill our destiny by performing mitzvahs. How do we do the mitzvahs? The Torah tells us how to do the mitzvahs, but the Torah doesn't just tell us in an open way. To us, in codes. So the Torah code here is, oy beged. Now the Gemara says the word detanya, and I have to tell you there's a big dispute about this word in the Gemara. Because the word detanya indicates that this is a braisa. A braisa means a teaching that's of the genre of the Mishnah. And if it comes from the genre of the Mishnah, then it's a problem. It's a problem because we're claiming that this is the opinion of Rava, but if it's the opinion of Rava, how does anybody else disagree with it? So Rashi says there's no detanya here. It's not a detanya. Loi gar sinan. He says, ima snite, if it's a Mishnah, hechi polagalov abaya. How could Rava's protagonist, Abaya, argue about this? It's a braisa, it's a Mishnah. So therefore, according to Rashi, this is Rava's own limud. Rava came up with this by himself. The Tosfos and many other Rishonim disagree. They say that this braisa is according to one opinion of the Torah Devei Reb Shmuel. There's actually two opinions, just like there's an argument between Abaya and Rava, who are Amoroyim, rabbis in the period of the Gemara, there's also differences, the same differences a generation before in the time of the Tanoim, the rabbis of the Mishnah. Okay, but at any rate, what is the limud? The limud, it says, beget. Should have said beget. Beget. If it would say beget, ainli ella beget. If it would say beget, what would it mean? It would mean a beget. It would mean a piece of clothing. I don't know what a piece of clothing is. Like I said last week, the girl who wore a paper dress at Woodstock, was that a piece of clothing? Or was she wearing a paper bag?
For her, it was a piece of clothing.
I know. When you looked at that, you say, yeah, funny, that girl's wearing an interesting dress. What'd you say? The nut bar is wearing a paper bag. Maybe that's not right. You know, nobody's a nut bar today. I'm sorry. I spoke offensively. That's an interesting article of clothing there. I thought it was a shopping bag, but I guess it isn't anymore. It's like when the nursery kids take those little bags and they turn them into puppets. And your kid comes, look, mommy, daddy, it's a puppet. I'm like, it's a bag. That's like a bad thing to say. They tell you the puppet, say, it's a beautiful puppet. It's such a cute puppet. Could I use the puppet? And they feel great. They created a puppet. So things change forms, yes? Okay. So how do we know what a beget is? How do we know what a beget is?
By the use.
By the Torah's definition. Because otherwise it becomes subjective. Everybody tells you what a beget is. Mm-hmm. Somebody decides to rap. I told you last week, you weren't here. I shared everybody a story, a funny story from my childhood. It came late at night. It was a Fabrengen. Anyway, bottom line is, we were little kids. We needed bedding. My father was in his parents' house. Didn't know, right? You were here. We had to sleep with tablecloths. Right? We thought that was very funny in the morning. But the point is, it isn't bedding. It's tablecloths. That's bedding for a table. It's not bedding for a bed. So how do you know what a beget is? How do we know? What's the answer? How do we know? The Torah says. Where does the Torah say? The Torah describes clothes? Yeah. The Torah makes a fashion statement? Yeah. Wow, I didn't know that. What kind of fashion does the Torah talk about? Not exactly fashion. The Torah talks about material. When it comes to tzaras, the Torah says that a beged which is made of tzemer, I pished him, which means wool or linen. So now I know that a garment is comprised of wool or linen. That's a Torah garment. A non-Torah garment, that's for the Torah. So up until this point, the only thing I would think of is beged. Beged must be what the Torah says a beged is. I don't know. We're talking Torah terms here. So somebody said, well, that's meaningful. Meaningful by whose accord? It's meaningful to you. Very nice. The question is, that meaningful from a Torah perspective? Rabbi, for me, it's matzah. Well, it's not really a matter. It doesn't matter if it's for me, it's matzah, or for you, it's matzah. The question is, for the Torah's perspective, is it matzah? Rabbi, for me, that's a shofar. I know, but it's not called a shofar according to the Torah. And for me, it's good enough. Fine. So then you could blow a shofar on December 13th and do whatever you want. But if you want to fulfill the mitzvah of tkiya shofar, then it has to be a shofar. And it has definition. And by the way, it has to be Rosh Hashanah. Everybody's lighting menorahs this week. I don't know what they're doing. They may as well blow the shofar this week. I need hum and tashin too. Like, I don't know what that means even. And as a rule, I don't participate in events that are not on Hanukkah events. I do on Hanukkah. Why would I do a Hanukkah event? Maybe I should do it on Purim also. It'd be economical. You get everything done in one day. You could dress up in a costume, bring matzah, maror, hamantashen, and latkes, and throw in cheesecake for good measure, and light a menorah and blow the shofar, and fast for the second half of the day to get rid of all the calories, and that's it. Then you're exempt for the whole year on Machiah. It also takes meaning out of our life, but whatever. So what is tkiya shofar? Tkiya shofar has a lot of things that go into it. There's a time that makes tkiya shofar. There's a shofar that makes tkiya shofar. Rabbi, for me, it's Pesach today. Okay, for you, it's Pesach. That doesn't work for me. Why? Because Pesach is not my construct. It's God's construct. So if the Torah says eat matzah when it's dark outside, it's got to be dark outside. If it's not dark outside, it's not matzah. It's not achilas matzah. And if it's crackers that were baked in 22 minutes.
It's still matzah, but it's not the mitzvah of achilat matzah.
Okay, fine, not the mitzvah. When I say matzah, I'm talking mitzvah. I'm not talking culinary thing. No, it's Torah has to be the source of our definition. So when it says beged, if the only time the Torah ever talks about a beged, the Torah gave us specifics about the beged. It says beged of tzemer upishtin. I know wool and linen is a beged, not wool and linen, then it's not a beged. So the Gemara says, Beged, in li elo beged. Shloisha al shloisha, b'sha'or gada minayin. How do we know? A beged is woolen linen. Even the Torah says a small, tiny little swatch, 3 fingers by 3 fingers. That's considered to be a beged. But what if you have a situation? We have a beged that's made of other material. It's not going to be 3 fingers by 3 fingers. It's going to be 3 tefachim by 3 tefachim. A tefach is a hand's breadth. So how do I know b'sha'ar b'god minayin? How do I know that by other clothing, it would still be considered clothing? And I want to be very clear about this now. When the Torah is telling us the novelty of what's called beged, the novelty is, for sure, we would say, if it's an article of clothing, it's an article of clothing. There's no question about that. Articles of clothing, the Torah says an article of clothing becomes tameh, it becomes tameh. The question is, at what point does an article of cloth acquire the designation of beged? If people call it clothing, it's clothing. That's the truth. If it looks like a duck and it quacks like a duck and swims like a duck and eats like a duck, it's a duck. It's clothing. It's clothing. Every human being in the world looks at it and knows it's clothing. It's worn by people as an article of clothing. It's clothing. It's not an argument. You can say, oh, no, the Torah said that's not a clothing. You're wearing a tablecloth now. That's not a tablecloth. That's clothing. But when the question is, how about a piece of fabric that hasn't yet been tailored? At what point can it be considered beged too? That was the issue over here. So the limud is, beged teaches me that if it's woolen linen, and if it's a tiny piece of cloth, it's still considered a beged. It's not just matter, it has form attached to it as well. However, because the Torah says, oy beged is a limud. A limud means an addition. Oy, the Torah is teaching me something. Oy beged means it's more than the other beged. There was beged as we knew it till now, which beged would mean not only would people call clothing, but beged would also mean a tiny piece of cloth made of woolen linen that's 3 fingers by 3 fingers. And now we're saying that because it doesn't just say beged, kli'etz u beged, it says kli'etz oy beged. So the oy beged includes what? Also other substances, other fabrics, but not tiny fabrics, but a little bit bigger. A minimum modicum size of what makes a fabric, a piece of fabric, not a piece of garbage, not a shmata, not a snippet, but actually a swatch, is for other garments when it would be 3 tefachim by 3 tefachim. You following the limud? That's the limud. So what's the Gemara going to do now? This is like really typical Gemara. So the Gemara now came back at Abaye and said, Rava, and where did you learn this from? Because you have an issue. You, Rava, said that there's a special limud by beged of woolen linen, and then another kind of fabric when it's not woolen linen. According to Abaye, it was very, very clear cut. Fabric, woolen linen, 3 fingers by 3 fingers. Full stop. That's it. Non-woolen linen, that's it. Doesn't become ritually impure. Unless it's actually an article of clothing. But according to Rava, an article of clothing, a piece of fabric of another material would still become ritually impure, would be a conductor of ritual impurity as long as it was not 3 fingers, but 3 tefachim, a little bit bigger. So we said, where's the source of that? So Rava came back and he said, I'll tell you where the source is. It's in Leviticus. It's right there in chapter 11, that it says word oy. The oy beged is an extra word. It teaches you that there's another kind of fabric that's sometimes considered to be a beged. So the Gemara goes back now and says, so you're telling me there's 2 limudim. There's 2 details. See, there's the nega limud, the tzaras limud, and then there's another limud, the limud from shratzim. So the Gemara says, if there's a limud from shratzim that comes together with a limud from tzoras, from the goyim, and Rava uses both of these different limudim in tandem, what would Abaye say about that second limud? What does it teach him? In other words, according to Abaye now, there's a superfluous lesson. There's a superfluous word in the Torah. What is it teaching you? What would Abaye say to Rava? Rava said, you see, it says over there, beged, ha-beged. That's by what we learned, the limud we learned last week. And now we learned a new limud. Now we learned the limud of Shiratzim. So the Gemara puts back Abaye. And what would Abaye say? And so the ping pong is going to go. Rava came up with an answer. So now we're going to throw it back to Abaye. If Rava would say this, what would Abaye say? Abaye. And Abaye. Hi, oy beged, my ovidle. What does he do with this limud? There's no extra words floating around. It doesn't make sense. Either you believe that every single word in the Torah is measured, and therefore every single word in the Torah necessarily is coming to teach you something, or it isn't. You can't have it both ways. You can't say, when I want, it's extra. Then it teaches me something. When I don't want that, it's just whatever, stylistic. Rava seems to make a good point. So the Gemara says, what would Abaye do with that? So he says, I'll tell you what Abaye would do with it. Miboyele. He needs it. He needs it. L'rabbeis sholish al sholish b'tzemer u'pishtin d'metame b'shiratzim. Abaye needs this because Abaye says, I know that a tiny piece of cloth, they're talking about very small, like smaller than a glasses cleaner, that tiny piece of cloth, up until now, I only know that it becomes ritually impure if the impurity we are discussing is negoyim, which is the form of discoloration at tzaras. What if it's a different form of ritual impurity? Namely, the ritual impurity of the sheretz, of the rodent. Well, if it's a ritual impurity of the rodent, then in that case, maybe I would say, when it comes to the nega, when it comes to tzaras, which is considered to be a very extreme form of ritual impurity, it can seize the smallest amount of fabric and work its way into it. It can attach itself to the smallest snippet of fabric. But shiratzim is not such a big ritual impurity. Shiratzim needs more to be able to hold on to. So the novelty, according to Abaye, is that the teaching that says that a tiniest snippet of cloth known as shalash al shalash, 3 fingers by 3 fingers, is effective when we speak about the tumah of ritual impurity engendered through the discoloration, through the nega, through the tzaras, that same principle would also apply when we deal with ritual impurity that's being the kind of ritual impurity which is known as shiratzim. Am I losing you? No? You understand? In other words, this. You're telling me that this tiny piece of cloth is considered to be something of value? That's a swatch? What, are you joking? What value does that have? By the way, just as like an aside, have you ever gone shopping for fabric? Or have you ever seen, sometimes they'll show you different fabrics like that they could use, they want to reupholster your couch. They don't come with giant bolts of fabric. They sometimes will come with a page, because people like to feel the fabric, not just shop online. Sometimes they actually want to feel. You still have salespeople up, upholsterers who come to the house, and they'll show you. Sometimes they have pages of fabric where it's shalish tfachim. They're actually like maybe a tefach, or 3 tefachim, like a book of fabrics. And sometimes it's a page, and on the page there's little squares of fabric. And you can actually touch the little square, and you can see it. And people make big decisions, decisions of thousands of dollars, based on a tiny piece of fabric. So it's not inconceivable that a tiny piece of fabric should be considered a keli, should be considered an artifact. There are times that could work. Now we have to know, does that work from a Torah perspective? This is the question. And what if it's not? So if you tell me, if it's in a book which is made to sell upholstery, then it works. What if it's just a piece of cloth? So the Torah told us that when it comes to the tumah of ritual impurity engendered through tzaras, when it comes to willow linen, the tiniest snippet is considered a swatch. It's an important piece of fabric. It's a conductor of ritual impurity. But Abaye says, how do I know that applies when I'm dealing with other forms of ritual impurity? In other words, Abaye's implicit logic is different forms of ritual impurity will necessarily have different operating systems. And they do. Each one has its own unique structure, halachic structure. It's very, very confusing Mishnayos, by the way. You learn these halachas. You learn one set of halachas, one set of principles. Come to it. The next kind of ritual impurity, Everything from the size to the nature, everything, the rules change. It's not necessarily ubiquitous. Then it comes even to artifacts, the rules change. If the artifact is made of wood, or it's made of metal, or it's made of clay, so then even if it's pshute, which means it doesn't have an indentation, it doesn't receive anything, it still becomes ritually impure. But when it's pottery, when it's cheres, pottery has to have some kind of hollow inside it. If it doesn't have a hollow, it can't become ritually impure. It's a unique halacha only by pottery. I'm just giving you an example of how the halachas change. Ritual impurities, forms of ritual impurity, and even objects which are susceptible, called tumas kelim. The tumah of kelim. What is a keli? What is not a keli? Depends what kind. So Abaye says that we need the oy beged to teach us that the rule of shalosh ha-shalosh by wool and linen is metame also bishnatzim. So the Gemara comes back now. The Rava. So Abaye then said that the teaching is taken. If the teaching is taken and it's used for wool and linen, how did Rava use that teaching for all different kinds of material or fabric? So the Rava says, Gali Rachmona Gabi Negoyim. The Torah tells it to us about Tzaras, Vahu Adin L'Shratzim. It's the same halacha with Shratzim. I don't need to be taught it in a special way. It's self-understood. If ritual impurity is going to be engendered in this kind of ritual impurity, with three fingers by three fingers, a tiny little snippet, same thing would apply to Shratzim. Interesting. So it doesn't need a limud. So then we take it back to Abaye. Abaye, you said you need a limud. Rava said you don't need a limud. Rava said it's implicit, it's self-understood. Abaye, what would Abaye answer then? Instead of this going back and forth, sparring back and forth. Abaye says, ikla mifrach. I can knock that off. You can suggest that they're the same, and I'll show you why they're not the same. Lemifrach literally means to topple. I can topple that argument. You made an argument. Who says it's logical? It's logical, but it doesn't necessarily mean it's right. There's all forms of logic. Say, logically speaking, A, B, and C. Say, well, that is a form of logic, but I'll show you why logically the opposite could be true. I said, I didn't think of that. So what is the truth? Oh, what is right? Just because somebody makes a logical argument doesn't mean that that's actually what's right. You'll have two very, very good lawyers. They'll both come and they'll make logical arguments where their client is right. And in fact, it's impossible that both clients should be right. It's not possible. But the lawyer makes a very logical argument. And the other lawyer says, no, I'll tell you why his argument is faulty and the law is being misinterpreted and my client is 100% right. Well, you need a judge to decide in the end. But the Gemara says here, Rava said it's self-understood that what applies to one applies to the other. So Abaye says it's not self-understood. Ikal mifrach, I could topple that argument. Why? Mal negoyim shekein shesi ve'ediv metama behem. Negoyim has a special halacha we learned about last week. If you remember, we talked about the fruit of the loom. We said that when negoyim happens, even if you're in the middle of weaving a garment, you didn't yet weave the fabric, it's still, the fabric is being fabricated. It's still on the loom. And as long as some of the fabric has already been tightened and come together, already it becomes ritually impure. So therefore, we see that when it comes to negoyim, the Torah is very stringent. So Abaye would tell you, you can't say whatever works by the nega works by the shratzim, because in fact it's not the case. If the sheretz, if the rodent, the dead rodent, falls on a loom which is laden, a loom which is loaded, a loom which is whatever word is used to set the loom or whatever it is, but it's not yet fabric, it does not become ritually impure. But if tzaras develops on the fabric and the making, on the fabric which is stretched over the loom, it does become ritually impure. So I cannot say, oh, whatever is by tzaras, whatever is by the nega, is necessarily going to be by the sheretz. Says who? Here's the difference. I showed you a Torah difference, where by certain halachas, it only applies to tzaras, and it does not apply to sheretz.
Here they have the 90 degree of the threads going in the loom. What about knitting, knit material?
I don't believe you knit. I don't believe you knit wool and linen. And tzaras only applies to wool and linen.
Well, you knit wool.
You knit wool. I don't know the answer to that. I these halachas are not really applicable, practically. So we don't learn this to get smicha. I'm not sure what the answer to that.
The question is, why do they specifically?
My guess would be
the reason is that they specifically state shtiva erev.
I'll tell you why. My guess would be that if somebody knits, only I'm selling this something from my childhood memories. My mother was a knitter. She used to knit.
Those are basically knots. Knitting is basically.
I know what knitting is. So once you knit three fingers by three fingers, I think that will become already ritually impure. But the thing is, with the loom, with knitting, you wrap the yarn on one hand, wrap the yarn on the other hand, and you have your knitting needles. There isn't a knit garment which is not yet knit. But knitting is either knit or isn't it. Otherwise, it's just a ball of yarn. But we're talking about a loom. Looms are very large. Loom could be like 6-7 feet and 8-9 feet wide. They're very large looms. So the loom already has a lot of work that's going in with the woof and the wrap and the back and the forth. It's all loaded up. It could take hours and hours to load up. And then when you actually pull the fabric together, it's relatively quick. The challenge is loading or putting everything onto the loom. So I don't think this shiloh would even apply, really. I don't see how it would apply. And by the way, since we're talking about knitting, so one of the things I remember my mother knitting is a baby yarmulke, like for a bris or whatever, mm-hmm. right? And the baby yarmulke was actually three fingers by three fingers with little straps tied onto the baby's head for his bris. Mm-hmm. So it's not so pashut. I remember.
Here they're talking shtiva erev. They don't necessarily talk about the loom.
Yes, shtiva erev.
Rather than about the cloth. 90 degree.
No, shtiva erev speaks about the loom, because whenever we're referring to cloth, to material, to thread, which is going shesi, and erev, which is going horizontal and vertical, we're talking about a loom. When you knit, there is no shesi ve'erev.
I think the process is called casting.
Casting, yeah, it could be. So I take it back. I think I do know the answer to that question. Once you knit three fingers by three fingers, if it's wool, that's it. It's tummy. If it gets saras. So we see there's a stringency by the loom that's not there by the shirotzim. And therefore, Abaya says that's entirely not a given, that if it's that way by shirotzim, it has to be that way by it says who? Kal v'chomer would not apply because there's not absolutes. Each one is different. How would you make kal v'chomer? The idach and the other one now, we don't even call it by name. Now we just go ping pong back and forth. The idach says, Isa g'daitach negoyim chamiri. If you want to say that negoyim is more stringent, then lichtev rachmanei gabe shtotzim. Then let the Torah just say the law by the more lenient one. Here you got your kal v'chomer. Say it by the lenient one, which means the less intense kind of ritual impurity, and then v'lesu, and then automatically you'll know it by negoyim, because if it's by the less intense form of ritual impurity, for sure by the more intense form of ritual impurity. So the Gemara puts back now v'idach, and what would you answer back to that? He says, I answer back to that very simple: negoyim mishotzin le'asu. You can't learn one from the other. Why? Because each has something that the other one doesn't have. The ikal mifrach. Because you could topple the argument again. The sheretz is able to become tamei if it has but the size of an adasha. Adasha is a tiny little bean. And the reason is a lentil. And the reason is because the chomet, which I think is a mole, it's smallest when it's just in vitro, when it's just getting in its earliest gestation. There's already a mole. It's the size of a lentil. So since there's already a fully formed mole that's the size of a lentil, so the halacha is that the mole, or with regard anywhere of the shtatzim, can already contain ritual impurity, carry ritual impurity if it's the tiny size of a lentil. But when it comes to tzaras, it has to be the size of a gris. The size of a gris is, I think, a Canadian dime. A Canadian and American dime. That's the size of a gris. So that's a little bit bigger than a small lentil. So there's special halachas for each one. And therefore the point is, Abaya refuses to say that you can necessarily learn one from the other, although Rava seems comfortable.
What's a sheret?
Sheretz is a creepy crawler. It means to slither. And I said there are eight forms of crawlers who are going to become conductors or the source of ritual impurity. And that's how we weave the other opinion. So now we know. The first opinion was based entirely on the rules of the ritual impurity that's connected to tzaras, to the nega of garments, that taught us about this tiny snippet of fabric. And now the rule of Rava, which where he has a two-pronged approach with the difference between wool and linen and other fabrics, where wool and linen is even a tiny snippet, whereas other fabrics actually has to actually be a swatch. For him, we would say you need not one pasuk, not just the verse that talks about the ritual impurity, which is called Negoyim, but also something extraordinary, something extra, something superfluous, what seems to be an extra word in the Tumah, the ritual impurity, which is called Shrotzim, the creepy crawlers. And that's how the Gemara goes, as they say.